We'd like to get started immediately. We have a packed program. I've asked the speakers to try to respect the time that we're given. We are looking at this session this morning, 30-minute sessions, 25 minutes of lectures, 5 minutes of Q&A following, and if we can keep to that program, then we will be able to be in sync with the rest of the morning. Without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce a new face to our lineup. Rabbi Gideon Weissman is from the Pua Institute to us here at our conference. We've already been exposed to the work of the Pua Institute. He received his rabbinic ordination from the Israeli rabbinate and currently serves as the director of the Pua Institute in the United States and attends the English-speaking section of the Pua Institute of Fertility and Medicine. So as Rabbi Jay pointed out this morning, the presentation this morning will be in English, so nobody has to worry. He is a visiting associate principal at the Einstein College of Medicine in New York, and he teaches at the Gruss Kollel and the Midrasha for Women. He's published numerously, extensively in terms of articles and books, and it gives me great pleasure to call upon Rabbi Weissman to discuss the issues of fertility in the 21st century.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for the invitation to come and speak with you here. I work in an organization called Pua Institute, which is based in Yerushalayim. We also have a branches and presence all over the world. Pua really deals with three major areas. One is counseling. We counsel about 180 calls every single day in areas dealing with fertility, gynecology, adolescence, sexuality, and many of the other subjects that are going to be discussed this morning. We also do supervision. We supervise fertility treatments to make sure there's no mistake they made in the lab. It's essential. And we're going to speak a little bit about supervision during our presentation in the next 25 minutes. So the talk is entitled Fertility, Past, Present, and Future. And there's really been a silent revolution. And we'll speak about the medical revolution somewhat. And then there's also been a comparable halakhic revolution. The revolution was really a silent revolution. It was the revolution of 25th of July, 1978. We're coming up to the 35th anniversary of that revolution. It happens also to be my birthday, the 25th of July. That's why I always remember the date. And it was the birth of this little baby, Louise Brown. And Louise Brown was the first test tube baby. Oops, we lost the picture, but I'm sure it's okay. The first test tube baby born. And that's got a lot of press recently because Robert Edwards, just won the Nobel Prize and also just died. So that it was sort of a lot of press recently. And that's, of course, not the past fertility, because fertility has been done for many, many centuries. But that's probably one of the greatest milestones in the lifetimes of most of the people here. There are several stages that we know, and I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the procedures. We have procedure of egg retrieval, we have fertilization, which can also be ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where we inject one sperm cell into an egg, which is also a revolution, but we don't have time to cover that today, but it's also a revolution. And then we have embryo transfer. And what's fascinating is that concept of having conception without sexual relations is really not a new one, because the Gemara already in Masechet Chagigah, many of you will know, speaks about the question of one of the scholars who came into the Pardes, Ben Zoma, went crazy and he asked him all sorts of wonderful questions. And one of the questions they asked him is, a woman who is a virgin, is pregnant, can she marry a Kohen Gadol? And the Gemara says, how is that possible? And one of the possibilities is she got pregnant in the bathtub, which means that, Rashi explains, that there was a man who went into the bathtub before, ejaculated, and then she immersed herself, and the sperm that was inside the bath somehow, in a miraculous manner, entered into her vaginal canal up through the cervix, through the uterus, and into the fallopian tube, and she became pregnant. But what's fascinating, and that's even Rabbeinu Hananel, one of the Rishonim there, said it's Ma'aseh Nisim, There was a girl recently who claimed that on her spring break to Puerto Rico, the same thing happened to her. She got pregnant in the swimming pool. After a deeper investigation, it was discovered maybe it was near the swimming pool, wasn't actually in the swimming pool. So it's somewhat miraculous. But what's fascinating, as the Gemara raises this fascinating case, is that what is the status of the child? And the amazing thing is that if we think about it, that for centuries, Jews were learning this Gemara, they were learning well before Daf Yomi, Jews actually learned Gemara as well, but they were learning Gemara, they were learning this Masechta Chagiga, they came to this passage, and it was sort of an interesting idea. But today this is very, very practical. What is the status of the child? And the Rishonim, Achronim, say that the child is kasher, the child relates to the parents, even though there was not only to the mother, but also to the father. So we already have a little bit of a basis to this concept of immaculate conception, if we want, or conception without sexual relations, which is really what IVF is. So as we said, fertility isn't a new thing. And this idea of having treatment, this idea of the rubric or the concepts already existed well before Bobby and Stefko. What's one of the most important aspects of our work is halakhic supervision. Here's a tshuva written by the Sitz Eliezer. And basically the idea is that there's a halakhic need because of human error. It's not to prevent malicious intent, which is really impossible to supervise, and we know that in Kashrut and here how much more so. But there is a need for having supervision throughout the stages of the treatment, from the giving of the sperm until right at the end, until frozen embryos are transferred later on, maybe years and years later, we need to have supervision. This is a really revolution, because the Sitz Eliezer, as well as many of the other poskim who wrote about fertility when it first came out in the late 70s and it came to Israel, early 80s, Israel is one of the major centers today of IVF for a number of reasons. A, because it's free in Israel, and B, because it's a Jewish need to have children. And also, Jews are pretty smart, as we did last night. So all those three things come together, that Israel's father's center for fertility. But most of the poskim wrote then came out against doing fertility treatments. And the reasons were various, but one of them was because a possibility of mistakes being made in the lab, and there were some very famous cases that highlighted the birth of twins, one of whom's white and one of whom's black, and various other things. There was recently an article, I think, in the Lancet or in the British Medical Association journal that said that there have been about 200 mistakes in England over the past 9 years. I mean, so that's a reasonably serious number. And so all the posting came out against it. And what's fascinating is that since we have supervision and we have halakhic guidance for the procedure, almost all of us came today are for it. And that's really a revolution, and I think that's something that in our lifetime we've seen the shift not only of the possibilities, but also of the permissibility. And that I think is maybe not merely many, many other aspects of our Jewish life, but here it really is. Just to give you one example, the Lubavitcher Rebbe came out against doing fertility treatment. And there's a very famous meeting between the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, as if I'm from both of them, and Rabbi Eliyahu said that under my auspices, supervision will exist, and I'll give the guidelines, and then the voucher only gave the okay to do fertility treatment. And then about 2 months later, we got a call from one of the lands in Israel saying, how come the voucher suddenly have all fertility problems? And we said, no, actually they had the problems before, but they never came to be treated. And so really, this is really amazing. Today, we can basically point at singular poskim who come out against it, and most of the times the psak isn't a halakhic psak, but more of a sort of metaphysical, spiritual problem, similar to what we heard last night about the Sabbath Rebbe, those sort of things. But really, all of the poskim are do commit and condone the fertility treatment. Of course, there are a number of questions that arise, and some that were mentioned before. For example, an egg donation. The question is it permitted? Who can be a donor? It has to be Jewish or not Jewish? And of course, who's the mother? We heard a little bit about that last night, a little bit of the question of that. Egg donation is really the next implanted into another woman's uterus with the sperm of a man, which we hope is her husband, although of course the possibility exists for not to be. And of course, once we can take the egg and grow it in the lab for 3 or 4 days or 5 days, we can also of course then take an egg donor, a sperm donor, a gestational carrier, and it can be raised by 2 completely other people. And so in the famous Gemara, there are 3 partners in the creation of a man. Today it can be 5, 6, 7 or more partners. There was recently a report in England, they just made a law that you're allowed to take mitochondria from one person to another person. So now there's a myriad number of possibilities. But of course, our poskim already spoke about that as we served with it last night. So the question of defining motherhood, of course, there are several options. It can be birth mother, it could be genetic mother, it could be both. This child will have 2 mothers. That will be an interesting combination, that you'll have 2 people telling him to clean his room up and take his elbows off the table and worrying whether he's going to get into law school. And it could be neither. In fact, to be a mother, you need to have both genes and give birth. And of course, as somebody mentioned last night, the question and answers is that, of course, this has a ramification also for surrogacy, for what we call today gestational carriers. Because the exact question is the exact opposite. The woman giving birth is not the woman who is the genetic mother. Of course, there's an argument for genetic mother, 3 partners in creation, we just said, and what the Gemara describes when it comes to speak about those partners, it speaks about very much genetic characteristics. The father gives white material, mother gives red material, and God gives the soul. Red material in the description of the Gemara seems to be genetic traits, seems to be things that the mother gives. It doesn't say mother gives, raises a child, or mother nurtures a child. It says mother gives red stuff and describes what that means. Of course, it's also, you could say, intuitive, that genes seems to be what determines who we are. We heard a little bit about that argument last night. Of course, there's the side of that it's birth mother. There's the famous story of Yosef and Dinah, who was switched at in utero, as the Paneh Parazi, one of the Gishonim, explains. And therefore, really, genetically, Yosef is the son of Leah, and Dinah is the son of Rachel. But, of course, we know that Leah is the mother of Dinah, because the Torah tells us. And we know that Yosef is the son of Rachel. And therefore, that seems to be an argument for birth mother seems to be what determines, not a genetics. And of course, we have a question which was somewhat alluded to last night, where if the woman converts during pregnancy, of course, the child will be born Jewish. And that would seem to suggest that birth is what determines, even though genetically, with all of our interest in epigenetics, how we can get a child in utero epigenetically to change its nature would be fascinating. And therefore, it seems to suggest that birth mother is what determines motherhood. But of course, we can say neither or both. Rav Shlomo Zalman is famously quoted as saying that I found the source for every single thing in the Torah apart from this question. There isn't really a classic source, and therefore we have to be particular in both. We have to be strict in both cases. And therefore, if we have a case of a non-Jewish surrogate mother, the child will need conversion. If we have a case of a non-Jewish egg donor born to a Jewish mother, the child would also need conversion. And there's been, and I think probably Dr. Reitman alluded to that a little bit last night, there's been a bit of a shift, although I think it's a bit of a red herring. I don't think it's really been a shift. And I think that mostly we don't know what a lot of those kids say. There have been very, very sparse tshuvot, sparse psakim that have actually been written. And most of the Torah of determining motherhood is really parashat Balta, it's really become an oral law. What did Rabbi Yashiv say? What did Rabbi Vladi say? There are books that attest to both directions. It's really almost impossible to determine. The people that have written about it explicitly, some have written that it's genetics. Yaakov Ariel has written like that. Rabbi Blight has an article like that. Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu was adamant that it's a birth mother who said not only do we the child not need conversion in the case of a egg donor, a non-Jewish egg donor, but it is a sore to participate in such a conversion because you are essentially casting a doubt on the validity of the child. What is really done, Lemaase? In America, what's mostly done, or in North America, including Canada, I think what's mostly done is Jewish egg donors. In Israel, Jewish egg donors for legal reasons that I'm happy to discuss afterwards, but it is a long and complicated complex reason, they really don't exist. And so really we have non-Jewish donors. And what we're noticing is that very few of these children are coming to be converted. And so we would say, lema'aseh, ipso facto, people are actually determining that what makes motherhood is in fact, of course, birth mother. In the surrogate issue, in the question of gestational carrier, the only person who wrote about it was Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. Rav Shlomo Zalman's son-in-law wrote an article in Asia, or was interviewed in Asia, I think by Professor Steinberg, who's here, that he said that surrogacy is permitted only with a single Jewish gestational carrier. And that is the position in Israel, that's the position that's being held. There are rabbis today, including Rav Shlomo Amar, the current chief rabbi for the next couple of weeks, who holds that genetic mother is what determines, and therefore he would permit gestational carrier with a non-Jewish carrier. A little bit of this in the background, it's very hard to find a gestational carrier. You can imagine that most people don't want to carry a baby for 9-10 months and then give it up, especially not single Jewish women. So what's developed is that in places like India or Armenia, there are baby farms where people can go and a woman will carry for a certain amount of money, she'll carry your baby. Not only do I think that's halakhically problematic, I think as human beings, we should come out against that. I think we, the Jewish people, not only people who understand the book, but also understand the heart. And therefore, that should be something that we as from Jews should speak out against. The conditions there are sub-conditions. The women are not necessarily there because they want to, but it's a financial consideration. And it is really a somewhat shameful that we as religious Jews can send women to use the services of such a woman, especially the conditions of their health. So a little bit of a hobby course, but I'll get off it now. Just a little bit about motherhood, which is a very classic question. Another question, something that we've written about extensively, was published in Home, and it's been published in other places, is the whole question of testicular biopsy. A new development is that we can now take one sperm cell and use that to get pregnant. And now anybody that knows a little bit of biology will remember that to be fertile, you have to have 20 million over 20 million sperm cells in every milliliter of ejaculate, and the regular ejaculate is somewhere between 2 and 5 milliliters. So millions and millions of sperms are usually used. Since the advent of ICSI, of intracytoplasmic sperm injection, at the end you're going to be tested on these acronyms, okay, so you better remember. ICSI is intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which wouldn't know. Since then we really only need one sperm cell. And so we can get there by men who have very, very low spermatogenesis, who very happy, really don't have very much sperm. We can get one sperm cell by testicular biopsy. The question of testicular biopsy is not new. Dr. Reichman sent me an article, I think, in the 50s already that it was being done. We wrote the article and thank him for that and for his support and for his incredible knowledge that he's helped me throughout our work. But the question of, we really enter into a very serious problem, because the problem is a castrated man can't enter into the house, into the congregation of Israel, which really means that there was a rub in Israel. Used to say when a couple would come and say, we did testicular biopsy and we got pregnant, the rabbi would say, mazal tov, now you have to divorce your wife because you can't continue being married to her. So, and he didn't mean it as a joke. You know, it sounds funny, but it wasn't. I mean, he really meant it. The Mishnah speaks about even if you have one testicle damaged. And so really, if we think about it, if we're damaging testicles, then we may, yes, maybe solving fertility problems, but in fact we are creating a problem of patsua daka. So how many times are we, on the one hand, helping people, on the other hand, maybe damaging their chances of continuing being married? The Gemara tells a very fascinating story about a man who went up onto a palm tree and fell down, and the palm frond damaged his testicle. And then the question was, but we stood up to if he had children. And so the Gemara says, well, maybe they weren't his children. Let's go and check out where exactly they were from. Which has a relevance to the question that we're talking about now. If we have children, can a person be considered patsua daka? Or what's the definition? Three poskim of the last generation spoke about this. Rabbi Barish, the Rabbi in Zurich, said that it's permitted because only when it's done in a destructive manner then it's problematic. You know, there's a difference between falling on a palm frond and getting your testicle stabbed, than going into the lab and doing it. We hope so. If you go to the lab and it's very much like having a pump from stuck in your testicle, then that's probably not a good lab to go to, and you should probably tell your friends that's not a good place. And so he said, Tirani, when it's destructive, would it be considered Pesuot Hakam? This isn't destructive, it's permitted. Rav Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss, the Alfred Din of the Eide Haridit, previously in Manchester, wrote, in fact, he said that this is an old question. I already discussed it with the Skan Aron, the Rav of Karlin, over 100 years ago. He said that the idea is that it closes up. The problem is leaving a hole, is leaving an incision, but the problem is that it closes up. Now, if we look at those two tshuvot, what they really say is it depends on bad damage to testicles. Whereas Rav Moshe Feinstein says, I don't understand, we just had a Gemara. The Gemara says if he's got children, he's not a Pesuot Hakam. So if he's got children, he can't be a Pesuot Hakam, would mean, therefore, the question is it successful or not? And what we wanted to say, and we present this in the paper, at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, was that maybe here we have two paradigms of understanding. On the one hand, the question is how much damage do we do to testicles? On the other hand, is success rates. And therefore, when we think about new techniques in acquiring sperm, maybe we should recommend either, on the one hand, that causes less damage, or on the other hand, that which has the best success rates, even though it may cause damage to testicle. And we look at the different methods. We look at TESI, which is taking air, which is basically a testicular biopsy, or we look at TEFNA, which is fine needle extraction, which causes less damage than TESI, or if we look at taken from the epididymis, or if we look at microsurgery, microtesting, which is sort of the gold standard now, which has really the least amount of damage. So the question, the paradigm to think about, is something that we need to discuss, and I think that here our tradition has a tremendous amount to say, is we've thought about what's important when we come to damage testing, what's important when we come to do treatment. That's a little bit about what we're doing today and a little bit how we thought about it. And of course, there are questions about Nidan, there are questions on Shabbat, and there are other sporadic questions that come up in fertility. Think a little bit about egg freezing, which is almost the future, but it's already here. 2 years ago, that would have been the future. Today, that's already everybody's doing it. We've changed the method of freezing eggs. We can vitrificate eggs, as many of you probably know, which is a way of freezing which causes less crystallization, less damage to the eggs. And the advantage of that is that we can preserve fertility for women undergoing treatment for cancers. We're going to hear about it, I think, a little bit today. But we also extend fertility. A woman who comes who's 35, doesn't want to get married, or didn't yet get married, can now freeze her eggs, and in fact is recommended to freeze eggs, which can then be used later on in an IVF and an in vitro fertilization. That fertility extension is becoming quicker and quicker the norm, especially in certain parts of the world in which careers come very much before having families, or in which communities in which not everybody, unfortunately, is able or has been successful in finding the person they'd like to spend the rest of their life with. Now, egg freezing means that the more we are going to do more and more and more IVF, because all of those women who are freezing are going to have to be using IVF. And they're not using IVF because they have fertility problems. They're using IVF because that's the way they tend to have children, because they pushed off their fertility. I was at a meeting of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine about 2 years ago, and the guys got up and spoke about egg freezing. It was very much embryonic at the time. And today, and he said, you know, I don't know whether my children are going to freeze eggs, but my grandchildren will freeze eggs. And the next speaker got up and said, I don't know what you're talking about. My daughter's already 28, and she already says when she hits 30, she's going to freeze eggs. So that's become the norm. The norm is that we don't need to get married. We can extend fertility. We can live forever. And everything will be okay. Well, we'll see in a moment, because there are two other things that I think that happen in the future. First is cloning. Everybody speaks about cloning. Everybody loves that. It's great. It's great articles. We haven't yet been able to do clone. We're not doing it successfully. The people who cloned Dolly have come out strongly against human cloning. But haploidization seems to be a much better, a much more possible future development. Haploidization is taking an egg of 46 chromosomes, a cell, and dividing it and making it a zygotic cell, making it back into being 23 chromosomes. So we can create egg cells, we can create sperm cells. So we can take a person who is doesn't produce sperm, has no sperm for genesis, a Klinefelter, XXY, doesn't produce sperm, and we can create sperm. Now, we usually call children the fruit of our loins, but if we take it, you know, maybe a cell from the cheek or from the ear, so what are we going to call children? That seems to be a development that's happening. It seems to be something that we will really be able to solve fertility problems. But the question that we have to ask is more better? Is it better to have more and more IVF children? Is it better to have children, we're going to speak a little bit later on today about genetics. We're choosing today, more and more couples are doing IVF because of genetic abnormalities and choosing to do PGD, which is going to speak about. So we're getting more, and we're having more women freezing eggs. We're having more people who are pushing off fertility. Are we going to have more and more IVF children? I was recently, six young people came to the office in Jerusalem from the Southern Hemisphere. They came on a trip and they wanted to hear a little bit about fertility. I gave them a few minutes talk. And when I speak about IVF, one of the kids picked up his hand and said, I was born through IVF. And all the other kids looked and said, wow, that's cool. So I said to them, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years' time, there'll be six people come. One will say, I was actually conceived naturally. They can say, wow, that's cool. Are you normal? So we don't know, but you know, we don't know what's going to happen. But I think that the future is going to be more and more for more and more elective things. And how can we say that's the end, or maybe just the beginning? Thank you very much. We have the question of cancer patients, the person got testicular cancer, which is very common, and we have to remove the testicles. So that's a category called Sris Kama. Sris Kama means that God has ordained this. The difference between being a eunuch is somebody who decided I want to do vasectomy, or I want to do some sort of procedure to damage the testicles. Different than somebody who does that to save their life. Yeah. Well, maybe shouldn't have been up on the pine tree uncarefully to begin with. But it's a good question. That's somewhat different. Everything we can say on some level is ordained. But the idea of having something that's pikuach nefesh to save someone's life is different than somebody does that electively. And I agree, but that was how we put that in the Gemara Yevamot, that speaks about the palm frond. That's an interesting question. But that seems to be that those two are different. Yes?
What if somebody is born with one?
Right, so born with one testicle is also, that the Gemara we spoke about, that's called Sris Kama. Sris Kama, literally, Rashi says, means that when he saw the sun, he was already castrated, i.e. that he was born in a situation that was, he only had one testicle, no testicles, but undescended testicles. That's not considered to be serious. So, yeah. So there was an article written in RJJ recently on that by a guy called Gideon Weitzman together with Rabbi Kahn from Karen Yavna, who wrote about that. Rewrote it in Pullman and rewrote it in my column in the Torah Tzitzis and the Jewish Press, that in my experience, almost all the poskim today would say that Brit Milah from IVF child does push off Shabbat. And therefore, that would seem to be an issue. So it was, and it's still weird, I think, what we spoke about, the revolution then, IVF has become pretty much the norm. It's become not last anything. And so that's what we discussed in our talk. So somebody at that point, yes.
According to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who says that with a sperm donation, you should use a non-Jewish donor in order to alleviate problems of Shema Yitzah Achoto. Right. Are we going to have the same with egg donations? Also, according to when you said the poskim that they should use a Jewish egg specifically, you'd have the same issues, I would think.
So Rav Moshe Feinstein never wrote about egg donation. Rav Moshe Feinstein told me that my father never wrote about it, never discussed it, but never wrote about it. We do have that. In fact, in Israel we have, when there are Jewish donors at the registry, there is an impossibility of two siblings marrying. That isn't the case in America. In North America, there's actually no registry. which should be. I mean, we should set up a registry that we can copy that. What we do say is that the couple should know some detail about the donor. But of course, you're often speaking about split cycles. You're speaking about two people getting the same donor, so those two could marry. They're also genetically siblings. But of course, it's somewhat of a chashash, it's somewhat of a concern that's a little bit improbable. Why? First of all, it's only according to those who say the genetic parent is the parent. So already 50% of the person comes to that, probably more. The other thing, of course, is that it's with the chances of two people marrying is somewhat unlikely. One of the poskim told us, if you go back, Rav Yaakov Ariel said, if you go back to the shtetl, so there were I come from Utsion. Utsion was a big place. But, if you go back to Utsion, how many there are? 150. In the whole of Vilna, there were 7 streets where the Jews lived. Now, we have to assume that not everybody there was faithful to their husband. And so it's also possible that some of the children born actually ended up marrying their sibling, right? How common was that? So if it's less common than that, then it would be considered to be improbable in the halakha. So it came with there's some number about how often that would happen to work it out. But that's, there's no, I'm sure that they have a registry. This one. We'll take one of this person's experience.
So the pros and cons issue, I'm just wondering if anyone has addressed the issue of, in the future, 55 and 65-year-old women giving birth to children.
Wow, I did that discussion about it yesterday in New York. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine had a cutoff point. I think it's 57, if I'm not mistaken. That's like a cutoff point. In Israel, it's 52 or 54 now. So there is a limit that's medically not imposed, but suggested. And I think that the last thing to say, the idea of how to get to a number is that what is the oldest woman ever conceived? So if you get to the oldest woman ever conceived, we can't deny that age. That's a bit of a debate. Who's the oldest one? I think it was a woman who was 90 years old, you can see. But apart from her, it's usually, we have cases in the early 50s where I can see. And so that's the idea of how we cut them. That's it.
Sorry, so talking about the future. So do you foresee a time where perhaps a child will be born without completely developed outside of
I think Hitachi have been trying to create an artificial uterus for a long, long time, haven't been able to do so. Which would seem to suggest that the uterus is more than just an incubator. There's obviously a lot going on there that we don't know about. What we know in the future, we can never say what we know in the future. The Rambam says that anybody tells you that I saw a ship flying in the air is a liar. I flew in a ship in the air yesterday. How can the Rambam say that? At the time of the Rambam, the advances were so slow that you could pretty much say that for the next 500 years. Today, we can only say what may happen. It may happen. We'll meet back in a few years' time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Weinstein. Pleasure. Our next speaker, I'm happy to say, really doesn't need an introduction on one hand. On the other hand, it's only appropriate to provide an introduction. Rabbi Professor Dr. Steinberg has been with us, I'm happy to say, since our UVM 5 years ago. So we are beyond the point of Chazaka. We have established beyond all of the different hosting events with that Chazaka. As I said, Rabbi Steinberg's introduction is difficult because to really try in a minute to capsulize so I'm not actually going to read you that you have the bio. What I just want to point out is that when we speak about tshuva and we talk about this tshuva and that tshuva, Rabbi Steinberg brings with us to this conference and to the he was there when the tshuva was brought forth and spoke to the poskim. So we're not dealing with an individual who, on one hand, has had an opportunity to provide and present and has so on and so forth. The ability for us to be able to hear literally firsthand. So when he has an interaction with Tzitz Eliezer, we speak of, oh, Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva. It's in that context that Rabbi Steinberg has indeed published the seminal work on Jewish medical ethics,
again, it's a real pleasure to be here for the first time, and I hope many years to come. And many faces are familiar from year to year, some are new, and they obviously are welcome to continue to come. I think there are so many interesting issues that have been discussed in these conferences and by such distinguished people that some of them we already have up to now, and we'll hear more later, so that I'm really very pleased to be here again and to present a few of the issues that I would ask to speak. Thank you, Dr. Kermit and Dr. Friedman for really organizing such wonderful conferences. I know how much work it takes. We come here to a ready-made place, but really to prepare all of it and to work with it and to invite people, and it's really a tremendous work that we should do it to your team. The subject that I was asked to speak this morning is sort of, I would say, even esoteric, in a sense that it's not a very frequent occurrence, but it has interesting aspects, both medically speaking, psychologically, and halakhically. So I guess that was one of the reasons that this topic was chosen. And it so happens that Shaare Tzedek, the hospital that I am affiliated with, is the Israeli National Center for Corrective Surgery of Ambiguous Genitalia. We get about 20 cases a year, which is a lot for a small country. Really, there's a lot of experience and discussions what is right and wrong to do. I want to distinguish between two concepts. One is an intersex or ambiguous genitalia, which is an inborn error, someone who's born with difficulties to recognize his sex. It is totally different from transsexualism, which is an elective surgery of someone who is either a man or a woman and wants to change the appearance of his sex. So that is a totally different issue, has its own halakhic problems, and it will not be discussed this morning. So what we need to consider talking about born people with ambiguous genitalia is the medical diagnosis. How do we know who or he or she is? What surgical procedures can we offer? There are a lot of socio-psychological aspects that have been developed, especially lately, in the last 10 or 15 years. There are educational aspects, ethical aspects, legal aspects, and obviously, from our point of view, halakhic aspects. So obviously, if a phenotype is also the genotype, there is no problem unless he elects to change his appearance, as I said, as a transsexual surgery. The problem arises when the phenotype does not go with the genotype, and then we talk about either true or pseudo hermaphrodite, and that creates major ethical questions. So from a medical point of view, there are three important factors that determine the sex of the person or the sexual identity of the person. The first and probably the most important from a scientific point of view is the genetic makeup. Is it an XY or an XX person? But even if he is an XY or an XX, he still can be a non-determined sex because it depends on the primary sex organ, whether there are testicles or ovaries, which produce hormones that create a secondary sex organs and characteristics such as the development of breasts, the distribution of hair, change in voice, and active puberty, and other aspects that have secondary signs of the sexual makeup. So we start with the fact that it's either XY and X person, but whether he has developed in utero the primary sex organs will determine how he will look. And that, in turn, will determine whether the secondary sex organs and characteristics Israel. So there is a very complex and complicated process in utero of a fetus to develop his sexual identity from a physical point of view, and probably also from a psychological point of view. It's beyond the scope of this presentation. It is very complicated, and the more we know about it, the more we need and must admire that there is a creator who is doing something that is really so complicated that we're only starting to begin to understand how it works. And yet we all were born and we are identifiable as male or female, and things went smoothly, except for those few that it didn't go right. So we talk about true hermaphroditism and pseudo-hermaphroditism, where in the true case, the person has both ovaries and testicles, and therefore the external sexual characteristics are of both sexes, and there are various subgroups. He can look a little more like a female, a little more like a female. In some parts he's closer to be a female, in other parts he's closer to be a male, but actually he has both ovaries and testicles, which produce the hormones that create external sexual characteristics. In the pseudo-hermaphroditism, it is divided into the female type and the male type. In the female type, he is from genetically an XX person, and therefore his primary organs are female, but because of certain hormonal problems, the secondary characteristics are those of the male sex. So there's a structure that looks like a penis, there is a structure that looks like a scrotum, although in fact it is a female organ that is enlarged or not divided appropriately, and at maturity the hormones are more male ones, and therefore he becomes more and more like a male. But in fact, he both the genetic makeup and the primary characteristics are female. So that is called a pseudo-hermaphrodite of a female type. The opposite is true for the pseudo-hermaphrodite from the male type, which is genetically an XX person, including the primary sex organs, which are the testicles and the penis. However, because of female hormones, the secondary sex characteristics are more looking like female, and puberty obviously will not menstruate, and then sometimes he's discovered to be really not a female, but a male. So when we see such a baby and we don't know whether he's a male or female, we need to correct him to one way or another, because to live in an ambiguous situation is very, very difficult. We'll come to it in a few minutes to see how things are looking today, but certainly until about 3-4 decades, it was clear that something has to be done. So you can do surgery early, right after birth, a few days later, you determine what you want it to be, depending on various variables that we'll discuss in a minute, and you correct surgically the abnormality of the opposite sex to the sex that you choose that this baby will grow into. You can wait with surgery to do it later on, and the question is when later on, that is another question, and there are even such propositions not to correct it surgically at all, leave it as an entity, as an ambiguous sex entity. The fact is that there are not enough scientific data to decide which of the three options is preferable, both from a medical point of view and from a psychological point of view. There are anecdotal reports to either direction which is better, but really not sufficient data. So the questions are to correct or not to correct. If correct, when is the right timing, who should decide about it, and finally, what is the outcome as far as we can tell today by either decision, whether to correct or not, when, and the decision maker. So here are some ethical questions involved. We are now in an era where autonomy is the prevailing, overriding ethical principle. I have some reservations about it, but that is how we look at it at the moment, at least. So the autonomy really requires an informed consent, not only a consent, but it should be informed consent. And the question is, whose informed consent are we looking for? So if we are doing it in a very, very early stage, the infant is the one that should decide. Obviously, he is not an autonomous agent. He can't make decisions. Even if we wait a little, then the child is still not an autonomous entity. So either you wait to him to become an adult and make his own decision, and then you can feel the autonomy in its fullest sense, or you rely on the parents that are surrogates for the autonomous decision of their infant or child who cannot give an informed consent. The opposing view to autonomy is what is called the best interest. So if you have a person who is not autonomous, who cannot make autonomous decisions, we are looking for the best interest. But who decides what is the best interest of this particular person? Now as a baby and looking at the future, well, where are our decisions, the decisions in his best interest? So it can be the parent, the physician, a religious leader, a court, legislation. There are numerous organs in society that look into the best interest of those who cannot make their own autonomous decisions. So obviously, the more people involved, the more institutions involved, it becomes more complicated and more complex, and there are differences of opinion. And the question is, who decides when there is a difference of opinion? Who is the final decision maker? And that complicates matters even more. So as I said, you can make several decisions. You can decide to do early surgery, which means within the first week of life, or a little bit later. You can decide to do it later or not to correct it. So if we choose the early surgical approach, the ethical aspects are covered as follows. Medically, it is certainly preferred. That's the best timing to do surgery. It's the less traumatic, the less problematic from a medical point of view, and therefore, medically speaking, purely medical speaking, that is preferred. It is also preferred from an educational point of view, because once you corrected the baby early, you send him to the kindergarten, to the school, as a boy or a girl, he knows his way, everyone recognizes him as the identifiable sex, because now he looks like this particular sex that was chosen, and therefore education is much preferred in this way. Also socially, children who run sometimes naked, if they look bizarre, they look undetermined, they become the laughter of the other children, and certainly from a social point of view, it is better for a person to be the way he is from early. The question is whether it is also preferred psychologically, in other words, whether the decision to correct very early and give him an identity that actually we impose on him, is that good for him when he grows up and becomes an adult? Is it psychologically better off by having been raised in a particular way, or would he be then disturbed because he would have chosen the opposite sex? From an ethical point of view, if we do early surgical correction, then obviously we're talking about a paternalistic approach by definition. Fathers, the father, the mother makes the decision for the child. There's no autonomy at all. There is a lot of best interest consideration as we enumerated earlier. Parents are the decision makers, like they are the decision makers for the entire life of their children. They make decisions of what type of education they'll get, where they'll live, who would they associate with. Many, many decisions are done by parents towards their children, and that is just another situation where parents make decisions for their children. By the way, just as a side issue, the whole argument now about Brit Milah, especially in Germany, where they wanted to forbid it, one of the arguments was that let the child grow up and make his own decision if he wants to be circumcised at a later age, and the parents are out of the picture. That is contrary to our understanding of the parents' role. The parents make decisions for their children. They make decisions that they should be circumcised, like they make decisions that they should get this type of education and not another one, and so on. So this goes within a wide discussion that is currently going on, what is the parents' role in their children. And obviously the parental informed consent is required, and the parents have to understand all the ramifications of such a decision. Now, if we turn to the late surgical correction, then autonomy is respected. Obviously, late would mean above the age of 15 or some kind of age that autonomy is already a factor, and therefore in current ethical circles, autonomy is very important, so we can respect it. The informed consent is given by the patient himself and not by a surrogate for him. On the other hand, there are socio-educational problems, there are medical-surgical problems, and again, whether this is better psychologically or not is unclear, because this particular person grew up as a certain sex or as an undetermined sex, and all of a sudden he becomes a determined sex. Is it good for his psyche? Is it not good? It's debatable. There are anecdotal stories to either direction. So on balance, I would think that from an ethical aspect, early correction is preferred when paternal decision-making and consent is the guiding line, and because they make all their decisions for their children, unless there is a compelling scientific data which would point otherwise. And as I said, at the moment, at least I couldn't find in the literature any compelling scientific data to say that early surgery is bad and late surgery is good in a categorical sense. So if it's debatable, if it's in doubt, I still think that on balance, it's preferable to do it that way. Now, when we turn to the halakhic point of view, indeterminate sex is divided or is called in the Talmud in three situations. So there's a tumtum, hymenomy, and androgynous. The tumtum, by the way, as you see at the bottom, is very rare if we define it the way the Nefoshim explained what a tumtum is. A tumtum is a form of ambiguous genitalia where the outer appearance of the sexual organ is covered by something, so that underlying this cover there is a clear sex, either a female or a male. It is just to the eye, something is blocking the appearance of the female or male sex, and therefore we don't know who it is. So today, if such case occurs, it's a very simple surgical procedure just to cut this coverage, and then you discover it's a boy or a girl, and it's easy to see. But in those days, they didn't do such procedures, and therefore he stayed as an indeterminate sex called tumtum. But it was known that he is either a boy or a girl, either a male or a female. We just don't know. So that has a specific halakhot regarding the tumtum, and there's a whole host of halakhot how to deal with such a person, as we'll see in a minute. But really, if you understand medically what it was meant, it is something very rare. The unable to give birth to a child because some reproductive system problem. What is it exactly today is available from a historic medical point of view, whether it's Turner syndrome or congenital deficiency of gonadotropins, but the description of it is that it is a female that has no breasts, no libido, absence of most pubis, she has a deep voice and paucity of hair. So this particular woman is infertile, looks like a female except for the secondary characteristics which are absent in partial ways. So that is called an hybrid. And the most interesting to us entity is the androgynous, which today we call hermaphrodite. Androgynous is a Greek word compound of andros, which is man, and gyno, which is a woman. So andros, gynos is a man and a woman combined. Hermaphrodite is also a Greek word, but that describes some mythological avoidozoa-type of entity. And today, in the literature, such a person who is a true hermaphrodite is called a hermaphrodite, whereas in Shas you won't find this term at all. And I assume, although I didn't see that anyone mentioned it, I assume that Chazal prefers the term androgynous, which means man, woman, and the same person, rather than an avoidozoa type of entity which would mix up people with the Greek mythology. But it's one of the same. So what is the status of such a person? So we find in the Talmud, like we heard earlier about who is the mother, and we find four options who the mother is. So we find at least four options. What is the status of an androgynous? One position is it's a doubtful male and a doubtful female. Another position is it's a unique feature, not determined whether male or female, or it is a separate entity that combines all three dots, male, female, and unique. And it is the first option that is half-half or partial, a little bit male, a little bit female. That has enormous modifications on how to relate to such a person halakhically. Can he be part of the minion? Does he need circumcision? What do you do with him at marriage? Can he marry a male or a female? Is it this or that? And it all would depend on how we identify this factor. Now, if we want to correct the true hermaphrodite or even the pseudo hermaphrodite, we get into several halakhic and theological issues from a Jewish point of view. The first and probably the most difficult one is the issue of castration, which I'll come to in a minute. There's also this biblical prohibition to behave like a female if you are male, or like a male if you are female. So if he is a male, he cannot wear garments of the female, and vice versa. So what will he wear? How would you relate to this? The gender definition is important, as we said, to use him as a minion of marriage and so on. And if we decide to do corrective surgery, is it worth the operative and hormonal risks involved in the change that is needed to make in him? And finally, how we blame God by making such a major change in a person's appearance and being, which I won't touch at this time. So, before we do a surgical correction, we base the rules according to the external appearance. If it looks like a male, he is a male. If he looks like a female, he is a female. If he looks like both of them, he is either both or neither or a specific entity, as we discussed earlier. So that is before cervical. So it depends what we chose, what we are choosing to do with this true hermaphrodite. We can transform him into a male by exciting the female sex organs. Remember, we're talking about a true hermaphrodite who has both female and male sexual organs, so we have to make him a male. For that, we need to excise his female parts. That halakhically has no problems. So halakhically, the easiest would be to transform a hermaphrodite into a male, because excising female sexual organs and making him a male has no halakhic problems. On the other hand, if we choose to do the opposite, if we choose to transform him into a female, for that we need to excise his male sex organs. Then we have several problems. Some of them were mentioned earlier. The prohibition of tsuadaka if we excise the penis, the prohibition of castration if we excise the testicles, and removing him for higher functioning halakhic realm, because the male is obligated to keep more mitzvot than the female, so we are reducing his obligations by making him a female. Are these problems in taking such a decision? So with regard to tsuadaka, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had a big chidush. I discussed it with him on a specific case that we had at Shaar Tzedek, and he had that as opposed to castration, to seals, in tsuadaka there is no prohibition to do that. There's no prohibition to cut off the penis. The prohibition would be, can he marry a woman? Can he be in Kahal Yisrael? But the act by itself is not prohibited. That's a major chidush that time doesn't permit to go into his reasoning, but that was a major chidush. As far as castration is concerned, meaning taking off the testicles, that, by all means, is prohibited to do. However, because he is a priori infertile, there are positions that there is no prohibition to castrate someone who is infertile to begin with. So the prohibition to castrate is someone who is fertile, making him into a non-fertile person. That is the prohibition. So in this case, according to those poskim, especially the Tzitz Eliezer, again, I had the privilege to discuss such a case with him. He held, according to the Minchat Chinuch, that there is no prohibition. But most disagreed with Rabbi Waldenberg and hold that castration is a prohibition, whether or not he can bear children or not, which by itself is a question. Some of them can have children, but even if they can't, that is a prohibition by itself. It's based on the response of the Chatam Sofer, but current rabbis have ruled against the Tzitz Eliezer. Now, the question, if we are allowed to take him away from certain of the commandments, again, Rabbi Waldenberg said that what counts is how the person appears outwardly. And it doesn't matter if he appears outwardly as a female because he was born as a female, or he appears outwardly as a female because you made him a female. Once he's a female, he has only the obligations of a female. Whereas, again, most of the poskim disagree and say that what we men made the situation does not take away the basis of this person who is a male. He was a male, he is still a male. The fact that we took off some of his organs does not make him a female from a halakhic point of view, and therefore she now will be obligated to keep all the mitzvot like a male, because to begin with it was a male. There are other issues that I don't want to go into, but As you can see, it is slightly complicated dealing with a true hermaphrodite. when we talk about a pseudo-hermaphrodite, where actually it is either a male or a female by chromosomes and by primary sex organs that are only of one gender, but externally it looks like the other sex. So if it is a female that looks externally like a male, then there is obviously, again, no prohibition to make her a full female. But if they have a male sex organ, and obviously they don't have the female primary sex organs, that's why they are pseudo-hermaphrodite, then the question to create something that will make her, again, a full female may come into questions that Rabbi Yashiv pointed out, and therefore he felt that that would be wrong to do. Now, again, if we talk about who is the person, I'm just mentioning it briefly because what I mentioned earlier, if you do a transsexual surgery, Waldberg went that far to say that even if a person was born as a male, looks like a male, is a male, by all means, and he now goes for elective surgery to become a female, he will be a female, because he looks now as a female. And that was rejected by all other poskim, and that doesn't make a difference in the person. If he was a male, he will stay a male, even if externally we made him look like a female. Thank you. Well, there's all ways of mixture. It can be XX, XY, XXY, XYY. It can be all kinds of mixtures. The problem with them, the problem physiologically is that already at an early stage, the hormonal makeup of the fetus in the pelvic stage created both primary sexual organs. And once the primary sexual organs are functional, they give the hormones of the both sides to make the appearance of both sexes. And therefore, he has both primary organs and secondary sexual appearance, like both a male and a female, in different combinations. Some look a little more like females, some look a little more like males.
So the contribution of the
XX is not helpful here because the primary sexual organs are both.
Is there a medical entity which corresponds to the chromosome?
Yeah, I said that there was one or two case reports that I remember.
Only a male, for example, but covered with a membrane?
Right.
And cannot be determined to be taking a membrane off.
Right. Yeah. But it's very rare, but it happens that there are case reports of such conditions.
Does it have a medical name?
No. I mean, he is a true male or female. There's nothing wrong with him.
Is there a term that one uses for that condition?
Not that I'm aware of.
Sitaliesa looked at only externals. But Levinson said to him that in the time of Chazal, they didn't know about chromosomes. So they didn't know that there was a discordance between phenotype and genotype. So the question is, now that we know that, are there poskim that have taken into account the genotype independent of the phenotype and have tried to consider whether that has any relevance or not?
Yeah, so I think Rabbi Yashiv was very strong at the field now with the issue of motherhood. It was very clear that to him genetics was an important halakhic consideration. What I heard from him was that he said he's sure that the genetic makeup makes a halakhic importance, but he has no source for it. So because he doesn't have a source for it, so for instance, in a motherhood determination, he would take into a doubtful situation the surrogate mother or the childbearing mother, although he thinks that halakhically she's just an incubator from a halakhic point of view. But because he doesn't have a source that genetics is the determining factor. Therefore, he says that the genetic mother is a real mother, the surrogate mother is a doubtful mother. So it's close to Shlomo Auerbach's position, who said he has no sources at all, and therefore both are equally mothers of the Chumra. He said that the genetic mother is mother, not only the Chumra, but halachically, and the childbearing mother is the Sofek mother. The same here. He holds that someone who is known genetically to be a male or a female, he is a male or a female, even if externally he looks of the other gender. Therefore, if you want to correct him externally, you should correct him what halachically is easier to fit what is real there. That was his position, as opposed to Rosenberg, who said, I don't know genetics, I don't know what you're talking about, I see it's a male, I see a female, it's a female. That could have been understood up to the point when he said that even if surgically you change the appearance of the sex, although you knew already that it was a male or a female, the transsexual surgery is someone who was born, raised, and grew up as a male or a female clearly, but there were no doubts about it. But he decided on his own will to change his appearance. And our Baumberg held that this is halakhically valid, that the way that he changed himself. That was very difficult to accept by most of the people.
Based on what Gary just reported, what our rest has said regarding creating a female from a sewer, and then it's a problem of creating a general practice. What about the patient who is a phenotypically normal female that has this genesis of the vagina and upper genital?
That shouldn't be a problem, even according to his positions. What he was worried about was homosexuality in a way. You create a vagina to a male, and you have relations with it.
But you also mentioned Shefa Zera.
Right.
So that would be, in this case,
right.
Is there a halakhic consensus among the poskim whether a doctor is permitted to perform transgender surgery?
Well, I think that I don't know that anyone talked about it specifically, but I would assume that the answer would be no for many reasons. A, you don't want to interfere with God's deeds in a way that is not medically necessary. There is a psychological aspect to it to some of the people. Some we don't even know that it's a real psychological problem. Sometimes it's like the neighbor does, so I do the same. There are such cases as well, but it is probably not sufficient to go into such a major change and risk from a halakhic point of view, even if psychologically they have some problems. In fact, what we know today about gender identification is much more complicated than what we thought earlier, and we said always no and forget about it, it's just a deviation and you shouldn't do it. Same holds for sexuality. Homosexuality is a capital crime by biblical law, and yet there are some people who can't be different. So what do you do with it? So there is an issue of onus all kinds of leeway, but certainly not the number that we see today. By its own means, is not enough to validate. Even according to the numbers that the gay community quotes, that there's about 10% of males who have homosexual tendencies, yet all agree that there's no more than 1 or maybe 2% of what's called obligatory homosexual, which by no means can act differently. So the other 9% have difficulties, but that doesn't mean that they can't work the way that they were created and the way they should have worked according to the biblical law. So how far do we take psychological tendencies into account is certainly an individual decision, but in general not sufficient to allow such drastic change.
What about the potential of marriage? You have implied that it's not necessary for the math today, and not for children. So I'm
Yeah, I mean, if the person would be imperfect anyway, no matter what you do to him, then today you can maybe correct it with modern fertility techniques and in other ways that in those days the surgeon couldn't do it. But the fact that he's imperfect to some of the post-gene is a valid argument that there's no castration prohibition.
But not, there are cases where they may be fertile.
Right, right. There are cases even of true hermaphrodites that are fertile. Whether the male or the female, I don't remember now what the statistics show, but the statistics one general.
That would impact your thing.
Right.
My
delivery, yeah.
I think we're
going to
hold it at this point, and during the break, then we will
the work is already been done by Weitzman and indeed also by
young cancer survivors is significant, as the majority of cancer patients less than 50 experience 5-year survival of 75% to 80% of our patients. But what's the major problem? The issue is, as you'll see both in the male side and the female side, that chemotherapy and radiation are toxic to the reproductive organs. So how does one preserve fertility in the male population? In the male population, it's quite simple. One would simply harvest reproductive seed from the male before he undergoes the chemotherapy or the radiation therapy. So adults or pubertal males can provide a sample, and ICSI, as was discussed by Weissman, allows for success even though there are a handful of sperm. Pregnancy can occur decades after storage, as we mentioned last night, and we'll allude to it briefly today also. So the issue is going to be, which is an issue which has been discussed extensively, which we're not going to revisit here, is simply how to procure that zera. And there are different methods of zera procurement, postcoital collection, use of condoms, use of drugs, etc. And post will discuss this with respect to assisted reproduction in general, and applies equally here in the issue of male infertility. Where it becomes a little more complicated from a halachic perspective is that if a man is married, then the hosoah zera, the removal of reproductive seed, is sanctioned in the context of marriage for the preservation of fertility. But should it be sanctioned for a man who is yet unmarried? Is it permitted for that person to have the reproductive seed and the sperm harvested? Does that individual have an obligation to be fruitful and multiply? Or does that obligation to be fruitful and multiply only begin upon the marriage to another individual? So here there are different approaches. So for example, Rav Bakshi Doron claimed that in fact, if the man is not married, there is no obligation for him yet to fulfill the mitzvah of Kuruvu. As such, there would be no permission for him to harvest the reproductive seed in this kind of scenario. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach thought that the following, that Ein Kol Hevdel Bein Ish Nasui Bein Ravach, there indeed is no halachic distinction. Whether the man is married or whether the man is not married, because the single man is also obligated to ultimately marry and fulfill the obligation for a move. But he also concludes by saying that, in my opinion, even a married man is not obligated to freeze the semen. The Holy Torah did not obligate a person to freeze semen. The sole matter of doubt with regard to this matter is only whether it is prohibited or permitted. And here we have an article which is more permissive in terms of using the harvesting the male reproductive seed from the unmarried individual. Now, what I'd like to spend a few moments on is where the technology has evolved, really fascinating new technology, and where the landscape will be changing over the next few decades' time. An area which hasn't yet been addressed significantly in the halakhic literature. So we said, for the male who is over the age of puberty, they can harvest the reproductive seed. And as we mentioned last night, the record now for frozen reproductive seed is 40 years, but of course there's no reason that it can't be 400 years or 4,000 years. But the real question is, in the children who are under the age of puberty, who don't have developed sperm, they only have spermatogonia. And spermatogonia, which is an early embryological stage of the sperm, cannot directly inseminate the egg and cannot successfully achieve reproduction. So the question is, how do you preserve fertility in a child who is under that age, who suffers from cancer? And here we have a very recent development. And that development is called spermatogonial stem cell transplantation. What that involves is actually harvesting the testicular tissue from the prepubertal child. And a number of things can be done with that, but in essence, it's really the same thing as what Weissman talked about extensively, that it requires a testicular biopsy. But that tissue can be used for two different purposes. Researchers, and this is from March of this year, researchers are investigating two methods for preserving fertility using cryopreserved tissue. involves isolating expanding populations of spermatogonial stem cells from testicular tissue. And there's actually two things that they can be used for. So once you harvest the testicular tissue, the spermatogonial tissue, one thought is to reimplant it back into that individual, and that individual will be cured of their cancer, and then it will naturally progress embryologically within that human being, and that man will be able to conceive naturally with his spouse subsequently. And the other notion is to culture or cultivate the sperm in the laboratory and use it to produce actual sperm with spermatozoa, and that spermatozoa can then be used with assisted reproduction, either ICSI or in vitro fertilization or even artificial insemination, in order to produce a child. And this is an example from January of this year where such a spermatogonial stem cell transplant was done into a monkey and actually was successful in producing progeny with the genetic of the donor into the monkey. But as we mentioned, the main issue in this case is the issue of the pseudococcal or serous causing a form of castration and perhaps rendering the person unable to marry into the polycerol, as was mentioned by both our wonderful presenters in the previous sessions. Is it permitted to do such a thing? Is it not permitted to do such a thing? The issue is, there's two issues. One is the issue of serous. The other issue with testicular biopsy, which is mentioned by some post-skin, is the issue of a zera, that they are not allowed to waste or remove the zera and any emission of zera, even removing that zera from the scrotum, from the testicle, can also be a violation of a zera. But interestingly, perhaps one could argue that in this particular case, when you're removing it from a prepubertal child, that zera isn't really zera, it's really spermatogonial sperm cells. That could never inseminate in any case. So since it's not really formed zera, it's not matured zera, at least that dimension, which some folks are concerned about, admittedly not all, may not be an issue in harvesting the reproductive seed from a prepubertal child. What about the, which is really the same issue, but it's the corollary issue, it's the issue of testicular transplantation, which is the possibility of taking, let's say, a child or an adult who underwent chemotherapy and wasn't able to avail himself of the new technology and didn't preserve his spermatogonial sperm cells. But the scientists will say, if we can offer you a donor, we can inject into your reproductive tract the spermatogonial stem cells of somebody else. And then you can conceive naturally with the testicular transplant of another individual. So what are the halachic issues that are raised for that? Testicular transplant itself has been done in the past. This is an article from the New York Times in 1920, the late 1800s, the early 1900s, but not in the way we would perform the testicular transplant now. The reason they were doing it in those days was actually to preserve or increase virility in males. They would transplant scrotal tissue or full testicles from animals into the human being. Thankfully, that research has not continued. Interestingly, there are a number of chubos that have been written in the modern era, specifically on testicular transplantation. Both of them, interestingly, seem to assume the technology has already been done, although in fact it really hasn't been done, at least not in the sense that the question was asked. And they actually assume in these cases that the transplants were done from cadaveric testicular transplants, and they discuss the issues of benefiting from the mates and nebula mates and things like that. But one of the areas that I wanted to focus on, at least to give us something to think about, is the parallels in the challenges to the definition of paternity that could arise with testicular transplant to the definition of maternity, which we've addressed in the conference and which Rabbi Weitzman mentioned as well. We know that there's major debates about who's considered the halachic mother, the birth mother, the gestation mother, the genetic mother, etc., etc. The question is, if testicular transplant were to become a reality, how would that parallel the debate of the definition of maternity, or would it not parallel? So in the case of peritoneal stem cell transplant, one could perhaps make a number of different arguments. One could say that since the sperm is immature at the time of transplantation and the maturation of the sperm occurs within the male body, that indeed, and it becomes integrated within the body, that indeed the recipient would be considered a halakhic father in such a scenario. Alternatively, one can make the argument that genetics is the determinant, as Leoshi believes, as I believe, through intuition. Ultimately, the genetic contribution comes to the donor and not to the recipient. So in that case, the donor should be considered the halakhic father as opposed to the recipient. So these discussions haven't really yet ensued, and I'm sure they will do so in the coming period of time. And of course, the challenge is that, unfortunately, tragically, many times the cancer's treatment is not successful. So people with harvested the reproductive seed, and they don't have successful treatment, but tragically, can that seed be used for reproduction by the family who wants to preserve the memory of a child or preserve the legacy of a child? And that the post we've discussed extensively is paternity generated posthumously. Is it not generated posthumously? I like to call this a situation of the posthumous paternity or postmortem pandemonium, because it really could generate the many unresolved issues for decades. You know, so a person can have a child after death. It affects issues of inheritance. It affects issues of the potential of evil, most likely not, and a wide variety of issues. So those are issues that relate to male oncofertility. What about female oncofertility? In principle, it's the same in that both the chemotherapy and radiation therapy can damage the ovarian and reproductive tissue. Here's a recent article discussing the many different options for women. There are more options for women. The options for women are also fascinating in their application. The options for fertility preservation for women include embryo freezing, which is freezing the fertilized embryo. Egg harvest, just the egg alone, as was mentioned by Weissman. Shielding the ovaries during radiation therapy, you know, ovarian transposition, which is actually physically moving the ovaries to a different part of the body, so that the radiation therapy doesn't actually affect the ovaries or affect them less. Ovarian tissue cryopreservation and donor eggs, which we will not discuss, which was discussed before. Now, the complexity lies in the following aspect of preservation for the woman in harvesting eggs from the woman, either for embryo cryopreservation or for egg preservation. And that's the fact that there has to be a controlled ovarian stimulation, which means you have to inject hormones to produce the eggs, which can then be harvested and have enough eggs, which would be useful for subsequent reproduction. The problem is that takes time and delays the cancer treatment. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that the hormones themselves, especially with respect to certain cancers, breast cancers, which are sensitive to estrogen, especially if the hormones are estrogen-based, can actually worsen the cancers that the patient is being treated for. So herein lies the dilemma. On the one hand, you want to preserve fertility, and there's tremendous drive and need to preserve that fertility. On the other hand, there can be tremendous detriment to the patient, both in terms of the time delay and the actual hastening of the malignancy in the actual Now, that issue of causing harm to preserve a pregnancy has been asked and answered in the halakhic literature. This is just one recent case which found itself in the secular world. And that's the case where a woman is actually pregnant with child and is diagnosed with cancer. And the cancer treatment is impacted by the preservation of the fetus. And here you have a fascinating dilemma in the Dominican Republic, which prohibits abortion. Abortion is illegal. And there was a young girl, a teenage girl, who developed a cancer. The cancer would have been best treated, and she would have been better treated if an abortion would have taken place. The problem was that the country prohibits abortion. So even though medically it was fairly indicated for her to have an abortion, the doctors were hesitant to perform abortion because they thought they would be hauled into court for violating the law, even though clearly unbalanced from a legal perspective, it would have been And this issue has also been addressed in the halakhic literature, and the poskim, as evidenced here, are clear that it is permitted for this woman to perform an abortion in order to save her life and to increase. embryo freezing is less problematic than sperm harvest. You said there's no issues of Ashvatsa Dera or Hotsara Dera for the female, so all those are non-issues. In embryo freezing, which the reason we mentioned even embryo freezing is because the embryo used to be more easily frozen than anything else. Nowadays, it's easy to freeze the egg alone, so people aren't required to find a sperm donor to produce an embryo to freeze. So it's really not so relevant as it used to be in the past. But the issue, some of the issues can be, if you freeze the embryos, it creates potential problems with ownership of reproductive material. You know, that subsequent stages, if you have frozen embryos lying around. And here there are many halakhic discussions about disposition of frozen embryos. If one member of the couple wants to use the frozen embryo for reproduction, the other one refuses to do so. Stuff that we alluded to a little bit last night. So in mature egg harvest, this requires a controlled stimulation, which we mentioned before, and the estrogen levels can cause a problem. This has the advantage that you don't need a partner at this time, but it will require a subsequent IVF with halakhic issues, for which you will assuredly consult the PUA organization for any issues that you have. It may circumvent ownership issues, but still the issue for posthumous use, the same as posthumous sperm use, you will have posthumous issues of posthumous egg use as well. There is a possibility, which is even newer than these other possibilities, to harvest immature oocytes, which does require ovarian stimulation, wouldn't delay the cancer, but may not be as effective, and that's somewhat experimental. Just in the last few minutes, I want to spend on ovarian tissue cryopreservation or ovarian transplantation. In this case, and this is what is done, is they would harvest the ovarian tissue. They don't induce the egg to ovulate. They simply surgically remove a piece of the ovary. And they can do a number of things with that ovarian tissue. They'll freeze that tissue. And they can return that tissue to the individual, and if they're shedding their cure from their cancer, they can try and insert it back into the body and restore natural fertility, which is an orthotopic autotransplant. Or they can even transplant that tissue. They'll need to have to go back into where the ovaries were. They can implant that tissue in other places in the body, in the abdominal wall, in the forearm. That tissue will then mature, then it will then harvest the eggs from that tissue and use it for in vitro fertilization to produce a child. And today, this is from the British Medical Journal in 2012, they reported the first case of what they believe. That worldwide, 13 live and healthy children are known to have been conceived through transplantation of ovarian tissue. But in this particular case, it was the first time in which this procedure is performed without having any traces of ovarian tissue in the patient. So clearly, the pregnancy was as a result of the return transplantation and not from the existing tissue. The other thing to appreciate also is that when you re-implant ovarian tissue as opposed to the sperm transplants, you have to acknowledge the fact that ovarian tissue might still contain cancer cells or the metastatic cancer from the original cancer that the patient was being treated. Here also there's the issue of pre-puberty. We talked about in the male. Here, ovarian tissue harvest, ovarian transplant, can be done in a child also. And the youngest child who has availed himself of this ovarian cryopreservation is a 2-year-old female. Just a fascinating historical note, which everybody watching this video is intimately familiar with also, and is written about, is the issue of ovarian transplantation, which in essence what is being done here. Fascinatingly, there is halakhic discussion in the early 20th century, 1907 to be exact, I'm not sure if they have a reference to them. There's in 1907 there's a reference in the halakhic literature, say in a halakhic journal called Vailaki Yosef. An entire legal discussion about ovarian transplantation and uterus transplantation. And the question was asked at that stage by Rabbi Gordon from England. He said, since physicians today are transplanting reproductive organs, I think we in the halakhic world should address these kinds of issues. What happens if they transplant the uterus, if they transplant the fallopian tubes, if they transplant the external genitalia, if they transplant the ovaries, what are the halakhic? So many people, and this halakhic literature has been perpetuated within the halakhic world for decades, not even within discussions about assisted reproduction. But it's fascinating that almost all people assume that initial halakhic discussion back in 1906 another area where people are looking or are seeking out ways to produce reproductive seeds, and just the reproduction of artificial seeds straight from the stem cell. The way our world is using it is the following scenario. We have the same sex couple who may have availed themselves of that standard discussion gender switching technologies. And I used to read the stories about men who were delivering children, who had the sex change operations, these sort of things. But in this context, you have a same sex couple where we can use the following technology. No child has yet been born, but here's the technology. You take a stem cell from the bone marrow, the stem cell can be cultivated to produce a gamete. Now, the gamete is the cell of reproduction. But here's the catch. It can produce either a sperm cell or an egg cell. So in theory, you could have a woman take her own stem cell and from her stem cell produce a sperm cell. She can then take her partner's egg cell, they can fertilize it in the laboratory, and either of them can carry the child. That way their child is produced with genetic material from both members of the couple. And I ask you, and I'm not going to give you the answer, who is the halachic father? Never in the history of humanity have we conceived, if you will, the possibility of a woman being able to donate the sperm to the process of reproduction. So if you think we had troubles with the definition of paternity and maternity before, think again. The other area is cloning, harvesting the cell from the cheek or from any other part of the cell to preserve fertility in patients who survive cancer who weren't otherwise able to preserve that fertility. And just in conclusion, Judaism, Halacha, clearly recognizes assisted reproduction and welcomes assisted reproduction. Rabbinic authorities allow for fertility preservation for serious procedures, though it is not necessarily strongly encouraged. And curious if it will evolve into more permissibility as time passes, as the technology evolves. Each procedure requires an independent legal analysis. The details are extremely relevant to Jewish law. Thank you very much.
Let's say you had the sperm collected, donor dies, and then you use it to fertilize the egg and the child is born. What are the implications for things like Yibum Chalitza, assuming it was his wife, and there were no other children before that, does she still need Chalitza? And what are the Yerusha issues?
Right, so the question is, does it constitute paternity or not? Yibum in particular is unique in that the person has to be with child at the time of death, which would not qualify here. So in general, all of these forms of posthumous reproduction generally would not disqualify the necessity for chalitza or yibum. But the question of Yerusha, the question is a complex question. And indeed, there's machlokes aposkim, Halberd's written about this, and Goldberg's written about this, and Kahn's written about this in terms of vary significantly in terms of permissibility altogether, and once the procedure has been done, about the how the consequences of the procedure, whether indeed that person would qualify as a legal child. And if indeed they qualify as a legal child and the Yerusha is required, the perpetuity of unresolved financial status in the state would wreak havoc on any community. And as we said, you can preserve the sperm 40 years, 400 years, 4,000 years. So imagine, 100 years from now, someone born with a posthumous sperm, from one of the richest families in the world. And actually, that's an incentive, by the way, to get that posthumous sperm, produce a child from a rich family so you can inherit and create your fortune.
Yes, but I have one from Chekhov. And the saving of fertility, preserving fertility, when we spoke to all of the poskim, was seen very much in Aspikov Nefesh because that is conducive for better prognosis and better results for the cancer treatment. So if you're taking a family, as you said, or shocked, they're in the headlights like a stunned deer, and suddenly you're saying, we believe in your future. We believe that this is going to get better, he's going to have children, and that is very, very important as part of the therapy for getting better. And so all of us people we spoke to were committed. The question, what do you do when someone doesn't make it? And disposing of genetic material is a different issue. But I think it is very important to say it isn't cancer treatment plus birth. This is part of cancer with all of the councillors for a high lifeline last week, and you know, saying this should be a essential part of the way that we treat cancer.
Should I ask one last question?
So the question is, actually, that case in 1906, you know, why was the rejection at that stage? And so the assumption is, in looking back at our retrospectoscope, the assumption is that it was small enough tissue that it wasn't rejected, or as he himself postulated in his own autobiography later, that maybe she had ectopic tissue somewhere else in which she became pregnant. She really didn't become pregnant from that. But in fact, the only ovarian transplants from non-related, from non-self that are occurring today are from identical twin sisters. So Sherman Silver in St. Louis, who's the pioneer of assisted reproduction, performed the first ovarian transplant today with sisters, with identical twin sisters. The only non-identical twin sister case that's been successful as yet was from a fraternal sister. And the reason that was successful didn't require immunosuppressant drugs is because that same sister had served as a bone marrow donor to his sister beforehand. So she had that sister's immune system already. She was able to receive the transplant from her without rejection. So the importance of treatment well taken. For sperm, it may not be as much of a problem, but it's a small amount of tissue. The ovarian tissue may be a problem.
Dr. Kadish will come back and we'll be discussing stem cell research at IBS. Just by the way, we, as I'm sure you're aware, we're a little bit behind schedule. 11, we're going to wrap up by 11, have a break till 11:20. So we're going to try to restart somewhere between 11:20 and 11:30. So a break will become shorter and we'll try to make this. We can have the questions afterwards, but we'll try to.
That's great. Thank you very much. It's been an interesting morning in the interest of time and avoiding overlap. I'm actually going to focus this talk a bit on a personal journey about stem cell research. You've heard a good deal about IVF. I'll talk a little bit about halakhic issues where there's overlap and where there's not overlap. In both cases involving embryonic stem cell research, as well as in vitro fertilization, there are some similar halakhic issues. But the fundamental difference, of course, is that in vitro fertilization, we're striving to fulfill the mitzvah of pura glue with the action that we're doing. So the issues of hashkasa zera, what you do with the fertilized embryos, and so on, are all produced in the process of actually fulfilling directly the mitzvah of pura glue. The difference when one deals with halakhic issues regarding embryonic stem cell research is that those advances that may take place as part of embryonic stem cell research are quite a bit further in the future. Second thing I want to say by way of introduction is that this talk may largely be of historical interest in the very near future. We spent a good deal of time looking way into the future last night and this morning. The reality is that there are a number of places that want to contain stem cells from cord blood, from bone marrow. But the 2012 Nobel Prize was given for induced pluripotent stem cells, and just yesterday, or actually 2 days ago, I can't be quite as up to date as Dr. Reichman, who I expect July 4th was there, but July 3rd there was a paper published using induced pluripotent stem cells to recreate a liver. So I think the issue of embryonic stem cell research may be of historical interest in the very near future, but nonetheless still an effective way to get stem cells for research. And my interest in this was piqued by something that happened to me about 2 years ago. So, in continuing one of the dreams of Dr. Lander Turo, which has a number of osteopathic medical schools, about 2 years ago we had the privilege of buying a medical school, which is something that doesn't happen very often. But what was more curious about the entire endeavor of purchasing New York Medical College is that we bought New York Medical College from the Archdiocese of New York, the Catholic Church. Now, what was the Catholic Church doing with the medical school? The other piece of it was they had a cash flow problem and were looking for ways to monetize some of their investments. So we had the privilege of buying York Medical College, and York Medical College was actually a faith-based institution and operated under the principles of Catholic Wahhabi halakha, so to speak. So abortion was illegal, as was embryonic stem cell research of all types, even the George Bush approved stem cell lines. So the question that Thoreau was faced with as we purchased New York Medical College about 2 years ago was what do we do about the issues of stem cell research and how do we handle the transition? Well, we handled the transition delicately because some of the previous administration that got the position was still around. But we reevaluated the halakha issues involved in embryonic stem cell research, even though a number of institutions, including Einstein, had already looked at those pretty carefully. We wanted to deal with this one quite gently, simply because of the change in culture of the medical college. So we do, of course, have a number of halakha authorities we rely on, actually an anonymous based on complicated historical reasons. But nonetheless, we became involved in what the issues were and how to deal with the halakha questions involved in embryonic stem cell research. So I want to briefly review some of those, many of which have probably been discussed here before and familiar to you, and then bring back that in context of how those halakhas relate to the halakhas of in vitro fertilization. So first of all, on the simplest level, there's the theoretical possibility that embryonic stem cell research, which takes place by taking fertilized egg and ovum that have been done in vitro, just like in vitro fertilization, taking those fertilized ova to the stage of about 150 cells, extracting a number of those cells, and culturing them to create embryonic stem cells, which are pluripotent, meaning they can become anything. And of course, since they haven't yet evolved, they're much more plastic in scientific terminology than even induced pluripotent stem cells, because these are cells that have never differentiated. So at first blush, one might suggest that there's some similarities between killing such a fertilized egg and abortion. So to try to review this issue about the issue of abortion, how that might apply to embryonic stem cells, we first need to try to review what the issue of abortion is. And this became an issue as far as the church position on abortion was as well. We're all aware that all halakhic authorities do not allow unfettered access to abortion on demand. But it turns out, even among modern-day poskim, there's a bit of machlokas about what exactly the issur of abortion is. And the spectrum of opinions about that, which has implications other than for embryonic stem cell research, is actually vast. And in many cases, some of the halakhic positions taken by modern-day poskim are surprising in terms of where we normally expect to find clippers. So we'll start with the first reference, which is in the handout, but it's also now projected on the screen. And in the interest of time, I won't read too much. But the Varish Harigas Uvar Asura Begisra Vitzicha Beba Akum Ben Yisrael. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that abortion is murder. Now, there's some nuances to that halakhic opinion, but it's the strongest modern day post-sec halakhic opinion about the halakhic status of abortion. And it's very clear, very succinct, and very definitive. Abortion is murder. Another modern day poskim, Rav Unterman, in the second reference, says, abortion is usher, even though there is no capital punishment, it's similar or a descendant of Ritzicha. It's not quite murder, but it's pretty close. I don't think Rav Moshe would actually hold that it would be chayav misa on abortion. Nonetheless, he says it's also mishum hariga. It's not clear if Rav Moshe has a slightly different nuanced opinion, but this is also a relatively significant and serious interpretation of the issue of abortion, which suggests that if we think about killing pre-embryos, we have to be very careful about our life status to be sure we don't end up in a case where we're talking about serious issues. Interestingly, some earlier halakhic authorities murder or even the issue of Kabbalah, it has to do with an issue of destroying sperm, even though it's indirect, it's happening much later. The fact is, you're taking something that was developed for the procreation process and terminating that procreation, leading to an issue of Hashkasas and all that else. The fifth opinion of the Tzitz Eliezer, is actually quite interesting, because what he says is, there's no capital punishment. And he says that there's an Easter, but that Easter is certainly not a biblical prohibition. And it may have nothing to do with killing at all. And it may, in fact, not even be a serious Easter of it in itself, but only an Easter because we're commanded to kill the world. And the practical implication regarding abortion, of course, is that one believes that this Easter is only because of the Yom HaShoah, of building the world, then what would be just much more makeable in the situations in which abortion would be allowed. And the Tzitz Eliezer says very specifically in this case that even in a case where there is a non-life-threatening danger to the mother, abortion would be allowed. So there are a couple of potential ways we can get away from the issue of abortion when one deals with preemption. Well, one is to use the 40-day issue. The 40-day issue is brought down in the Gemara Nivamos. It talks about the issue of a bas kohen, a woman of a kohen who's married to a non-kohen man, and unfortunately he passes away. And the question is, can she return to the state where she was single, where she didn't do it? And the answer that Gemara gives without going into details is that she's allowed to eat truma right away, because until 40 days, the fetus is considered maya bahama, like water in general. If one were able to take that to its logical extension and talk about the fact that abortion before 40 days would be allowed, then the entire issue in regard to embryonic stem cell research would become moot, because I mentioned it's usually at the 3 to 5 or perhaps 7 day stage of the embryo when cells are harvested for embryonic stem cell research. Unfortunately, this idea that the halakha by Yavama is extended to allow killing the fetus under 40 days old is not accepted by law authorities, and particularly by Moshe Feinstein, without explaining how his opinion interacts with the Gemara Nivamos, rejects the idea that one could kill or perform an abortion under 40 days. And what he says is that you would be, there's another halakha that you could be Makal Shabbos to save such an embryo, and therefore it must be the case that you're not allowed to perform an abortion even under 40 days. Now, there are two important, however, halakha distinctions between an abortion and taking a fertilized egg that's in vitro and killing it. And those two are interrelated but serious. And what those reflect is the fact that the pre-embryo is neither implanted nor able to grow as yet into a human being, because as you heard earlier this morning, artificial uterus is not yet a reality. So it's neither implanted in a woman nor is it capable of growing into a human being without further activity. And because of that, in the next couple of references, both Rav Wasner and Rav Chaim Lever Halevi both suggest, A, the pre-embryo does not have the same halakhic status as an implanted fetus or embryo, and B, that has implications both for embryonic stem cell research, but as well as in vitro fertilization. What are you allowed to do, for example, to save the pre-embryo? You've got a situation where there's a power failure on Shabbos. Are you allowed to intervene to save the pre-embryo for the future? The answer is probably not, but the fundamental reason for that is that the halakhic status of the pre-embryo is not identical to a fetus that's in vivo, and therefore, based on this assertion, one can generally avoid the concern about whether there's a problem of killing the pre-embryo similar to the property of the fetus. That takes one that remains is, in fact, the issue of Hashkas HaZera. Because if you look at the idea that abortion is usher because of Hashkas HaZera, you have the following scenario. Even though there's a huge amount of time, days or weeks or perhaps even months, between the time that the sperm was initially created, ex vivo, and the time that one's intervening, the idea is that Hashkas HaZera can continue over time. So when you back fertilize pre-embryos, you still have the issue of Hashkas HaZera and the question of whether one could destroy a pre-embryo intentionally for medical research, as opposed, of course, what's the other alternative? The other alternative is to leave the fertilized pre-embryos, Ashiyavo and the other, to use an analogy from the field. Even though you may not be using them immediately, if the idea that Hashkas HaZera would still apply to those pre-embryos is in fact true, one wouldn't be able to actively intervene to destroy those pre-embryos. One would simply have to leave them alone. And that could potentially apply, that user of Hashkas HaZera could potentially apply, even in the case when one is intentionally taking a pre-embryo for scientific research. So let's try to go back to the issue that I started with and go to the last set of references, which is the question of, we are doing some good with scientific research. In fact, several folks have argued that one should encourage the use of pre-embryos in scientific research because they're not being used anyway and they could have a positive aspect of it. The fundamental difference between in vitro fertilization and embryonic stem cell research that I mentioned earlier is the question of how immediately is the benefit that one is going to get from that activity. To put another way, if we use an analogy to the halachas of Shabbos, is there a requirement in terms of this potential issue of Hashkas HaZera of Chol HaLefanim? The idea of Chol HaLefanim is if you have a person who's seriously ill on Shabbos, a physician can do whatever is necessary to save that person's life. But if as a cardiologist, I said, I'm working on a new technique to cure sudden death, I want to go into my laboratory on Shabbos and continue that work because the more I can work on Shabbos, the quicker we're going to create a cure for cardiac disease and the more rapidly we will be able to intervene to save people's lives. No one would suggest that that activity would be allowed because it doesn't meet the definition of Chol HaLefanim. So in this case of Hashkas HaZera, the potential use of Hashkas HaZera regarding pre-embryos or abortion, if we indeed had a requirement to Chol HaLefanim, there would be a real question about whether we would be able to destroy pre-embryos even if for the purpose of doing embryonic stem cell research, because it would be hard to argue that we would meet the definition of Chol HaLefanim in doing embryonic stem cell research because the benefits of that stem cell research would be several years away. The bottom line is we do have a case in the Gemara that suggests that in relation to the issue of Hashkas HaZera, that Chol HaLefanim is not required. And that's the case of the Gemara Nivamos. And without going into detail, the question there is, it's a question that was discussed earlier today, which is a question of if you have someone with a reproductive abnormality, with a hole in the reproductive organ, the question is that person capable of being a father? And therefore, can that person get married to someone who's born Jewish? And that's an important distinction of that born Jewish, because someone's a tzuadaka kushatva, if they're capable of fertility, they could fulfill the mitzvah of kru ravu if they marry a gioris, a woman who converted. But the case in the Gemara, Marni Bomo spoke about, is a case of can we induce a seminal emission, Hashkas HaZera, in order to find out whom this person can marry? Not whether he can marry, not immediately to fulfill the mitzvah for Rebu, but who can marry. And the answer that the Gemara gives, although there's some question that was discussed just a few moments ago about how do you do this, the answer that the Gemara gives is yes, it's allowed. In the case of Nikam Benisna, it's allowed to induce seminal emission to create what otherwise could have been considered Hashkas HaZera in order to determine whom this man can marry. And what that suggests, and there are other what that suggests is that in the case of Hashkasa Zera, we don't require Kol Lefanim to allow, as long as there's a purpose down the line, whether that purpose is deciding whom someone would marry, or whether that purpose, for example, is to allow embryonic stem cell research to occur as part of using already fertilized pre-embryos for scientific advances and scientific purposes. So the end of the story is that we do allow embryonic stem cell research in New York Medical College. Although we have a number of scientists who are working on pluripotent stem cells, there are some who are using embryonic stem cell research. There's a new New York State initiative to fund some embryonic stem cell research that we're competing for. And although I don't have any answers that we've cured cancer or created artificial liver yet, we're hoping that combined with other techniques we'll be able to get there. We gently and quietly said we're not quite as mocking as the Catholic Church. Go ahead and try to save some lives. Thanks for your attention.
Now, the worry about the problem there, I think, stems from the certain misconception. The problem there is a time of emission. Once it's emitted, there is no problem. You can destroy it, there is nothing there. The purpose of emission has to be for feasibility. In a data, then you do it. If you do it differently or for a different purpose, then the question is whether the world has crossed the law or not. Once it's emitted, once it's in the world, I mean, we do it all the time. I mean, we do it whatever we need to do. We emit in the Mandela. There are millions of going to go. So our position was that you're allowed to destroy part of the fertilized eggs as long as at the time that the emission of Zera was for the purpose of propagation, and there would be at least one fertilized egg that will be used for the purpose of propagation. So if you have an IVF clinic and you have 20 eggs procured from a woman, you fertilize it. You did it for the purpose of procreation for the child. You implanted one or two of the fertilized eggs. Also said the garage was not there. The story is that you can use it with
the popular Tosfot. The question is, Shoshan Shashivamon, whether it's the
jury,
the ball or afterwards. If it's afterwards, going to the reef, then the mission should have said
right. So I thank you now, but I actually have asked
that we posit that there is not.
Right. software,
right.
that every emission of cement, you emit 20 million, one goes, and you're not communicating to I will from a shop of 20 million.
That's right.
Thank you. I think Paul, you were